Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Sophia Korb, discussing new research on the use of psychedelics for healing. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald, and Danielle Levy, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I find that over the past few months here on Two Jewish, I've been talking less and less about Israel than over any comparable period in a very long time. Usually that would be good news. No wars waged against Israel, no terrorist campaigns against Israeli citizens, no wildly biased international criticism, no Islamist caliphate jihadis approaching Israel's borders. You know, no news, in the Middle East especially, can indeed be good news. But nowadays, I think this absence of a focus on the latest news from Israel is more from political exhaustion than anything else. Of course, Israel is the only true democracy in the region and one of a dwindling number internationally, if we're honest about the way world politics seems to be going all authoritarian of late. But there are times when I must agree with Winston Churchill. Democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Israel has now had two national elections, and the divide in the electorate has been pretty much identical both times. Bibi Netanyahu's right-wing government fell last winter. After the April national elections, he failed to form a government and then used a parliamentary move to call for another round of elections. And after those elections in September, Bibi again failed to form a government, and now Benny Gantz is given the opportunity to form a government, and that too looks like it will fail, leading to yet another election, which will likely end with a very similar result. Well, of course, we're going to be somewhere between exhausted and bored with the whole mess. The good news is that Israel continues to muddle along just fine with no clear direction in its national leadership. The economy continues to be robust. Development is obvious all around the country. Tourism is flowing in at historic levels. Active Judaism is incredibly vital and increasingly diverse everywhere. And, of course, there is not currently a war in Gaza nor any Hezbollah missiles landing near Haifa. And look, what could be a more definitive definition of a Jewish democracy than a population that votes at an incredibly high rate and in which everyone seemingly wants something different? So we'll just cope with our increasing ennui with regard to the seemingly eternal Israeli stalemate of prime ministerial politics and talk mostly about other Jewish subjects. To play us in this morning, here's Israeli stars Yishai Ribo and Omer Adam and their beautiful song, Halev Sheli, My Heart, about how only God can heal the heart of the world.
Halev Sheli nikra lishnayim, ma shelo ata shivcha lamayim, kmo sufa min hayam olem, kmo tofa shel Miriam poem, ve'en trufa ba'olam. הלב שלי מרים ידיים, כבר מועד לא עומד על הרגליים, שבר כלי שאין בו כבר מה, השמיים הם לי חומה, איך אבוא בתוך הים ביבשה. ורק אתה יכול להפוך מספדי למחול, לזכך את החול, לרכך בי הכל. רק אתה מבין איך לגשת ללב שלי, משכך כל כאב שבי, מרפא את הלב. לשניים, חציו אשר וחציו לשם שמיים, כמו סופה מן הים עולם, כמו תופעה של מרים פעם, ואין תרופה בעולם ללב. רק אתה יכול להפוך מספדי למחול, לזכך את החול, ללקח מי הכל. רק אתה מבין איך לגשת ללב שלי, משכך כל כאב שבי, מרפא את הלב.
That was the lovely song Halev Sheli from Yishai Ribo and Omer Adam. And only you can turn my mourning into dancing, to purify the sand, to sanctify all in me. Only you know how to approach my heart. You lessen any pain within me. You heal my heart. Our guest this morning, Sophia Korb, is a PhD psychologist who works in a remarkable program doing and promoting new research on the use of psychedelics for healing. Meet her when we explore this fascinating subject in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Sophia Korb has a PhD in clinical psychology, and she's a researcher on a fascinating program run by something called the Fadiman Group, exploring psychedelics and microdoses and their usage or potential usage. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So for those of us who remember Timothy Leary and LSD in the 60s, that's certainly one of the principal psychedelics you guys are working with. Mm-hmm. Everybody was supposed to tune in, turn on, and drop out, and then it became very controversial, and I think a lot of us lost track of it. Can you tell us what's going on in research here and
sure.
how you got involved?
So after the 60s, there was a 40-year research ban where not that much research was happening about psychedelics. The earlier research that was done in the 60s looked at psychedelics as a psychotomimetic, meaning it mimics psychotic
behaviors.
Yeah.
Something that seemed like a psychotic behavior.
Yeah, it turns out that it's not great at that. Instead, psychedelics are a different type of experience, an experience that may in certain ways be unique. And what we're researching right now is people who take very small doses of psychedelics regularly to have some sort of benefit or effect in their life. So they're not experiencing hallucinations or that much noticeable changes in thought patterns.
It sounds kind of like CBD oil as opposed to people that smoke marijuana in large quantities to get high. It's using the same substance, but for a different purpose.
Sure. I mean, CBD is, and I don't research marijuana in particular.
Sure.
CBD is one substance that's found in marijuana. Another is THC, which is
the theoretically, I don't know if psychedelic really, but
psychoactive.
It's a psychoactive drug,
yeah.
Right.
Whereas we're looking at people who are taking, say, between 1/20th and 1/10th of a recreational dose. So much, much smaller doses
so
of
really
the same thing. Yeah.
Okay. What potential benefits are you guys exploring? What have you found? This
yeah.
is really interesting.
So people are reporting that their depression is easing. Some people with mixed depression and anxiety say that their depression is easing and their anxiety is better. People are saying that they have more freedom in their personal lives with their families, that they're more gentle and kind. People say that they're more creative.
Very interesting. We will talk much more with Sophia Korb about these microdoses of psychedelics and the Fadiman Group and the way the research is conducted when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, north of Ina, on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night, 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. If you have a birthday in November, we have a special blessing for you. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Join us this Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, Beit Simcha, on the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to Beitsimcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue community in southern Arizona in its beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, or would like to advertise on Too Jewish, email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about where the Jews of the Balkans came from and what the Balkans are. Came to some agreement on that. The initial Jewish settlement going back to ancient times, and then the next big influx coming from the expulsion from Spain, 1492, and thereafter, and the invitation into the Ottoman Empire. So that's a Jewish community that goes back to the 15th century. That gets us within 500 years of today. Let's move a little bit forward from
there. Right. As Winston Churchill once famously quipped, the Balkans have always produced more history than they can consume. And the excess of that history also has affected the Jews there. So when Jews first arrived, not only from Spain, by the way, but also from Portugal, many of them were quite wealthy, or if they had lost all their material wealth, they still had the habits of wealthy people and aristocrats and still considered themselves better than other Jews.
And so, they had skill sets, usually, of some kind or another.
Yeah, they were highly literate, but so were the Jews already living there. So, for example, in Thessaloniki, the oldest kernel of the Jewish community is called the Romaniotes, because they were there before the Romans came.
Right.
Before Jesus came. Then Thessaloniki, for example, became overwhelmingly a Sephardic Jewish city. In fact, it was the only city in Europe where Jews were not quite a majority, but the largest of all the minorities. There were about 35% of a population that was quite mixed.
It included, I don't think there was any one majority population. And no. What's sometimes called Salonika and right. Turks and Thessaloniki by Greeks.
Right. So it included Greeks, of course, but it also included Turks, Armenians, Macedonians, Bulgarians, Serbs, Roma and Sinti,
the gypsies,
politically correct term for gypsies. Right. They were all there, and none of them had a percentage of the population as large as the Jewish percentage. So the language of the marketplace became Ladino, which was the Spanish that the Jews brought with them from the Iberian Peninsula late in the 15th century, early in the 16th century. This repeated itself in many of the port communities, which became overwhelmingly Sephardic and Ladino speaking. None of them became as large or as important historically as Thessaloniki, which I think was once called like the Jerusalem of the diaspora, yeah, or whatever, right, yeah, Jerusalem right. of the Balkans. And that's, by the way, where I'm leading my next trip to. But in any case, I digress. So the next big wave of Jewish settlement came as the Austro-Hungarian Empire penetrated into the Balkans. And this was a result of Ottoman weakness. The Ottomans started declining probably already in the late 18th century, but certainly by the 19th century, which is the 1800s, of course, the Ottoman Empire was referred to as the sick man of Europe. And the great powers were all waiting to carve up this bird. It was like a big Thanksgiving turkey, and Russia, France, Austro-Hungary, and the UK were all looking at what parts of it they could capture. And of course, taking advantage of Ottoman weakness, the Brits in particular helped the Greeks fight a war of independence and break away in part from the Ottoman Empire. Now, what's interesting about
Lord
that
Byron
is...
Lord Byron famously was involved in that. That's right.
Right. But that was only southern Greece. So what today is northern Greece, Thessaloniki, the example par excellence, remained part of Turkey until 1913. So that's fairly recent history.
100
and
years. Yeah.
The Jews there had a very interesting challenge in changing their identities from Ottomans to Greeks.
And we'll explore more about this really fascinating part of the world when we come back next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Inbal Shtivi, our Mivina on Israel, director of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
We've been talking about Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, the city of peace, right? The center of the Jewish world religiously.
Definitely.
Jerusalem had a problem not too long ago, which is young people were not staying in Jerusalem. They didn't.
Yes.
They would finish school and then they'd leave for Tel Aviv or they'd leave for somewhere else.
Yes. I think that part of the issue was that young people had much fewer opportunities after they finished university in Jerusalem. Culturally, financially, all of those things. Jerusalem was going...
The high-tech sector wasn't high-tech. In Jerusalem, it was in Tel Aviv, and then it was up in the Galil.
Definitely. There were other places in Israel that were prioritized in terms of high-tech industry and all of that. So young people looking for opportunities would just go to Tel Aviv or other places, but normally central Israel. That was the case. Living in Jerusalem, those that are less able to get out.
Right.
Okay, those that are less able.
They
yeah.
weren't as skilled or they weren't as sophisticated.
As educated for the workforce or right. Skilled for the workforces. So it's kind of
a circular problem. And so yeah. So what did they do to change that?
As far as I understand, they had a set of policies. They have decided that it's a priority to leave those young people inside Jerusalem, and that it's a priority to increase and engage the arts sector in this process. So now you have different festivals, arts festivals going on in Jerusalem throughout the year.
Seems like every month there's another one.
Every month yeah. there is another.
Cinema, all kinds of stuff.
All right. kinds of stuff. There are the traditional festivals. There is the book festival that's been there forever. There's the film festival, the Jewish film festival that was there forever. But new stuff is coming up. Festival Mekudeshet, which is new, relatively. And so many others. So it has become a cultural hub in itself. In a way,
competing with Tel Aviv.
With Tel Aviv, yeah. That's probably a healthy competition.
It is really so healthy, and it gives so much work to other people who are in this business. And and it creates an identity, I think, of Jerusalem.
Kind of an intellectual identity, actually, if you think about it. I mean, okay, the government is there, but still, like, that's very interesting. You know, I love Jerusalem. I lived in Jerusalem. I don't know that I feel as strongly about Jerusalem as you feel about Tel Aviv, but it's possible. but it's wonderful to see that. And also to see, you know, there's such an active cafe scene there now. And
completely. It's totally...
restaurant scene. Yes. You know, there's just so much going on.
And quite eclectic. And it's not the same chain stores that are...
It's not all the American stuff that's coming over, or the European stuff.
Very much boutique, and it has a feel to it. Every place has its own feel.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. We will definitely talk about Tel Aviv down the road, but thanks for your reflections on Yerushalayim.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Three Jewish brothers get together to talk about the gifts they sent their mother for her 90th birthday. One, Milton, is a successful doctor. The second, Marvin, is a powerful lawyer. And the third, Melvin, is a prosperous businessman. It's too bad their aged mama lives so far away in another city, but they've really gone all out. Milton, the doctor, said, "I built a big new mansion for mama." Marvin, the lawyer, says, "I had my Mercedes dealer deliver her a fancy Mercedes limousine with a Mercedes-trained German chauffeur." Melvin, the businessman's son, says, "You know how Mama loves reading Torah? Well, she can't read anymore. She can't see so well. I met a rabbi who told me about a parrot that can recite the whole Torah with commentary. It took 20 rabbis 12 years to teach him. I had to pledge $1 million to the temple, but let me tell you, it was worth it. All Mama has to do is name a Torah portion and the parrot will chant it and give the commentary." Well, soon after her 90th birthday, Mama sends her sons thank you notes. She writes, "It's a shame none of you could make it here for my 90th birthday because you're all such big shots now, but thank you for your gifts. First, Milton. The house you built for me is huge. I live in only one room and the kitchen a little, but I have to clean the whole house. Thanks a lot." Next, Marvin. "I'm too old to go anywhere. What do I need with a fancy car? I stay home. I have my groceries delivered. I never use the Mercedes except to go to the doctor. Plus, the driver you hired is a Nazi. He's eating me out of house and home. But the thought was good. Thanks anyway. Ah, but my dearest Melvin, you are the only son to have the good sense to give some thought to your gift. The chicken was delicious." Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Boker Tov.
Hello. Shalom uvracha.
So you guys are incredibly fluent in English.
We don't have a choice.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're very welcome. I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. And obviously they send you out to represent Israel. It's good if you're fluent in English. You're obviously fluent in Hebrew. Danielle, you're also fluent in German, having lived there for years. But in Israel, what's stunning is to go to Tel Aviv and see signs all over the place in English now, to me. You didn't used to see this.
Actually, we did because we were born to that reality. Yeah.
Right. So in your lives, it's always been
right.
Like that.
Yeah.
Right.
But Israel
is...
So
it's like to be 18.
I mean, Israel is being like really a popular destination now. I feel like people all over the world. If you go to Jerusalem, you could hear French and German and English and Russian and everything possible.
Right.
So I feel like it's like the wisest thing to do. I mean, you have everyone from all over the place, and like English is a language that combines them all. So it's everywhere, for sure.
The how much English do they teach you in the schools in Israel?
Oh, it's really low level. It's really
so it's actually depends like in the in the peripheriot, like not in the middle of Israel, so the level...
The periphery.
Yeah. So the level...
Which is a term that's only come in the last like 5 to 7 years. They talk about, you know, Beit Shaan is in the periphery, Be'er Sheva is the periphery. Anything that's not Yerushalayim, Tel Aviv, Haifa...
What you would know.
You know, surroundings.
So like the level is different and... The spoken English that they teach you in school, it's not really useful.
It's just not very good.
We've been taught like grammar and just like to write essays and everything possible, and then it comes to like actually speaking, and no one can really do it.
Yeah,
right.
So
yeah, so in a way, in the same way that in Hebrew school here and in day schools here, we teach Tefillah and Tanakh.
Yeah, so
but if you try to buy, you know, tomatoes,
they don't really know how to talk and understand Hebrew.
Yeah, like basic conversational Hebrew isn't really a problem. Right. You kind of make a choice. By the way, my kids never learned grammar in school. I mean, they learned it, but they never had. You guys probably get more structured grammar in English than they teach in American schools now. Is it different in the big cities? Do they give you more English, or is it just that you pick it up because so many people speak?
I think like for me, I just picked English from songs, TV shows, series, and have good fast catch. But I don't know.
Sports,
yeah, of course. Maybe, I don't know. People just don't want to.
You know, Daniel, in Europe, it's very common for people to speak 3-4 languages, right? It's very normal. Is that true in Israel, do you think?
I don't think so. I feel like Israelis, the Tzabar Israelis, they stick with the Hebrew, and I would sum it up there. Because like they know, they would, like, I mean, the people who know, they will be going outside of Israel.
Well, everybody goes outside of Israel because after the IDF, they go on a three-month or six-month.
Exactly. But like in 3 months, you can't just like deal with like...
Find Israelis wherever you go.
And like
you follow the Israeli trail.
Yes. Yeah. And they come back to Israel and just like end up staying there. So why bother learning a lot of language? So.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do think English is way better in Israel than it used to be, where people thought they spoke English and they didn't at all. But yeah. I'm sure you're right that it's better some places and not so strong.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, in which God tests Abraham by having him almost but not quite sacrifice Isaac on a rock. Famous for being read on Rosh Hashanah, its connection seems to be the fact that a ram appears at the end of the story, caught in a thicket by its horns, the model for all future shofars. But this passage, taken from the Torah portion of Vayera, is much more than a mere animal story, cryptic, yet oddly repetitive. It raises a host of painful moral dilemmas, challenging us to think intensely about just what our relationship to God truly is.
God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where do you want this killing done? God said, on Highway 61.
In Vayera, God tests Abraham Adonai Nisayet Avraham, commanding him to sacrifice his son, his only son, his beloved son Isaac. The problem here is the fact that Abraham, who's previously shown a tendency to argue and fight injustice vigorously, obeys this terrible command and does so with apparent relish. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God. In fact, we're told he gets up especially early in the morning to fulfill this horrible command with energy. The narrative itself sets up the drama beautifully, painfully, tragically. Isaac, who doesn't know what's happening, goes along with his father. The phrase, the two walked on together, is repeated, and Isaac asks, where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham replies, correctly but ironically, God will provide. It's a troubling scene. And then as Abraham is about to slaughter his son, raising up the knife, an angel of God intervenes and the murder of the innocent, the sacrifice of Isaac, is stopped. Isaac lives, and the future of our people, Abraham's children, is thus preserved. The story, in its place and time, was undoubtedly a polemical tale designed to teach the prohibition on human sacrifice. Children are not meant to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of the human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. God desires life. Other religions have carried this Akedah story to a different, bloodier, more horrible conclusion, believing human sacrifice and suffering are the essential elements in religious life. But the story of the binding of Isaac makes it clear that killing our own kids and the glorification in the loss of a child will never be acceptable to Jews. In fact, Abraham's urgent rush to fulfill God's terrible command to kill his son reminds us that we have the unfortunate ability to embrace morally bad decisions with great fervor. And many, many times in history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were far from ethical. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen paraphrased this in his piece The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife as they sojourned both of them together. Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. Wilfred Owen wrote of the ways his elders sent his own generation off to die in the trenches of World War I, but we still engage in such choices, and like Abraham, we still often fail the test. May we learn from the Torah and this Akedah of Abraham's to choose life and not sacrifice for our own children. Our guest this morning, Sophia Korb, will explain how new discoveries in the use of psychedelics help people with chronic pain, psychological disorders, and other ailments in innovative ways. Find out how when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In European anti-Semitism news, a sadly constant theme of late, the leader of the French far left accused French Jews of inciting assault against him and falsely asserted that it promotes violent sectarianism that he said doesn't occur among Muslims. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, leader of the French Unbowed movement, spoke against the CRIF Federation of Jewish Communities in France during a televised interview last week. Sectarianism's always been a problem for the Republican idea, Mélenchon, who often uses anti-Semitic rhetoric, said. Take CRIF. It produces blatant, violent, and aggressive sectarianism, namely against me, right? To the point of encouraging people to hit me during a demonstration like the one for Mireille Knoll. Mireille Knoll was a Holocaust survivor brutally murdered in her Paris apartment last year by a Muslim neighbor calling Allahu Akbar. CRIF, the Federation of French Jewish Communities, asked Mélenchon and the leader of the far-right National Rally Party, Marine Le Pen, not to attend a commemorative march for Mireille Knoll. Both politicians came anyway. Participants booed them until police escorted the political leaders away. CRIF did not call for violence, which did not occur at the event, and it condemned the booing. Milan Shan, who continued to call CRIF bizarre, folkloristic, and ridiculous, did not name any other group as responsible for sectarianism in France. Asked whether sectarianism exists among Muslims, Milan Shan said no. They have delinquents, same as anywhere, but none claim their law supersedes others. Huh. Really? Mélenchon, who won a fifth of the votes in the 2017 presidential elections, in 2014 called French Jews an aggressive community preaching to the rest of the nation. He is just flat out an anti-Semite.
Ah, yes, I'm sorry. I'm afraid the Jews were right.
And in Britain, a key ally of England's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, who has downplayed the party's anti-Semitism, has resigned. Labour lawmaker Chris Williamson quit following the party's decision not to have him run as a candidate in the December 12th general election in the UK. Williamson said he will run instead as an independent. He was suspended this year for saying Labour is too apologetic in responding to allegations consistently rejected by the party that it has become institutionally anti-Semitic. Back in June, he was readmitted to Labour and then again suspended 2 days later amid a backlash over his readmission. Under Jeremy Corbyn, who has called Hamas and Hezbollah his friends, the Labour Party has become a safe space for those with vile attitudes towards Jewish people, a British Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry determined in 2016. Labour's handling of anti-Semitism is currently being probed by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, a government watchdog. The Jewish Chronicle, the paper of record for the British Jewish community, last week recommended against voting for Labour in the coming election because of Corbyn's anti-Semitism. In his resignation letter, his ally Williamson made a series of innuendos suggesting that scrutiny of Labour's anti-Semitism problem is traceable to Zionist Jews or Israel or both. He falsely wrote that the Jewish Labour Movement, one of the party's oldest chapters, was revived in 2015 at the same time as the State of Israel launched a diplomatic strategy to delegitimize Palestinian activism on the left and normalize Zionism in our movement. He added that he's the victim of a witch hunt that serves far-right activists, including the Jewish Defense League. I didn't know the Jewish Defense League still even existed. Some good news last week from South America. Players on one of Brazil's most popular soccer teams wore Stars of David on their jerseys in order to remember Kristallnacht, the 1938 pogrom that marked the Nazis' beginning of the Holocaust. The Corinthians team's players took the field with yellow stars embroidered above the club's logo. 22,000 supporters watched them defeat Fortaleza by a score of 3-2. Many of the seats in the stadium also displayed yellow stars with the message "A Star Not to Forget" printed on them. The team opened a photo exhibit about the Holocaust. November 9th to 10th, 1938, many Jews were murdered and hundreds of Jewish storefronts were smashed along with synagogues burned in Germany and Austria, beginning Kristallnacht. In times of so much intolerance, hate speech, xenophobia, and racism, this initiative is an example of love for the other, of commitment among peoples and nations, said Rabbi Toivo Weitman, head of the Sao Paulo Holocaust Memorial. The Corinthians team has a lot of support among Sao Paulo's 60,000 Jews. Corinthians was founded in Bom Retiro, the Sao Paulo neighborhood once heavily populated by Jewish immigrants. It is today home to several Jewish institutions, including the Holocaust Memorial. The team's Kristallnacht campaign was financed and promoted by the Holocaust Memorial and a private Jewish-owned advertising agency. Soccer jerseys are going to be auctioned, the funds donated to the Holocaust Memorial. Portuguese language video about the team and why it decided to remember Kristallnacht publicly premiered before the match quickly went viral on social media, getting massive media coverage in Brazil. Back in January, the Corinthians posed for a photo on their home field holding a poster with the hashtag #WeRemember in honor of International Holocaust Remembrance Day. That got some 50,000 likes on social media. 2018, Corinthians wore uniforms featuring the names of the 11 Jewish victims of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. Ariel Gelblung, the Simon Wiesenthal Center's director in Latin America, said, "This is the example for football clubs to generate good practices and unity between peoples rather than hate and division. Faced with the spread of Holocaust denial, the Corinthians propose memory." Founded in 1910, Corinthians is one of Brazil's most popular soccer teams. It has over 30 million fans. It's listed by Forbes as the most valuable soccer club in the Americas, worth almost $600 million. In Jerusalem, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews canceled plans to build a $60 million outreach center for visiting evangelical Christians. Work on the planned seven-story building in the Talpiot neighborhood near the U.S. Embassy with a view from its roof of the Temple Mount already was underway following a groundbreaking last year. The building was expected to be completed in 2022. Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein, founder and president of the Fellowship of Christians and Jews, who died back in February, a past guest of Two Jewish, winner of the Kohan Foundation Memorial Award for work on behalf of the Jewish people. Eckstein founded the center as a place to train visiting Christians to combat the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, BDS, against Israel, and to bring more Christian tourists to the country. His daughter Yael, who took over as president of the fellowship following his death, said the organization canceled the plans in order to focus on its core missions of helping Jews in poverty and promoting Aliyah, rather than getting involved in BDS and tourism. The decision was approved recently by the organization's board. She called it a hard decision. The project had been her father's baby. Yael Eckstein said the organization has already spent $14 million on the project, but planned to recoup it through the sale of the building and the land. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Sophia Korb is a PhD in clinical psychology and a lot of experience working with a program that explores microdosing with psychedelics run by the Fadiman Group. Tell us about, well, Fadiman, I guess, and how all this evolved.
Sure. My mentor, Jim Fadiman, James Fadiman, is an expert in LSD. He's been researching LSD since it was legal the first time.
Like way back in the 60s, before the ban, the 30-year ban on research. 40-year ban on research, sorry.
Yeah, so he founded my graduate school, the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, and I was hired as to do quantitative analysis as a graduate student. His research group needed someone to do math and statistics.
Uh-huh. And you're the math statistics person.
I'm the math statistics person.
Very impressive.
So I was brought on to do statistics and math. And then when I needed work later on, I asked for more work. And I eventually was hired full time. And we started this microdosing project.
So started the microdosing project. Do you dispense it? How do people like do this?
So right?
And also, if you don't dispense it, how do you control quality in this process?
So we don't dispense any drugs. One of our email templates.
For those of our listeners who are disappointed, I really have nothing to say to you.
One of our email templates at work is, "We are not drug dealers."
That's good. Good to know. We appreciate that.
So the history of the idea is as follows. Albert Hofmann, the inventor and creator of LSD, thought that...
Should be noted, it's a synthetic drug originally, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Unlike many other psychedelics, mushrooms or whatever that actually grow naturally and then people extract stuff from them. This was an invented drug, I guess.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah, I think that there are things that are very related to LSD in the wild, but when we're talking about LSD, we're talking about a synthetic substance. So Albert Hofmann thought that if people took about 20 micrograms, and a tab of LSD, let's say a recreational dose is 100 micrograms, just to have a round number,
right.
You can in the wild, you can...
Now, by the way, that is not legal, we need to say.
It is not legal in the U.S.
Right. Although in Europe and other places, some other places, it is legal.
Yes, and if you're a subject in some of our participant in some of our trials in other countries or in the U.S., you might have dispensation to carry LSD and to use LSD.
Right.
But in general, our participants don't have that.
Right.
And when Hofmann invented it, it was legal, and then it
became illegal after. Correct. Right. Right.
So he thought that if people took a small dose, like a fifth of a tab, so 20 micrograms, there could be some sort of health benefit. So he said that in one speech, and he told his student Robert Fort that, and Robert Fort told James Fadiman. So James Fadiman mentioned it to some people, and what happened when I started with the Fadiman Group was that we were being mailed journals, handwritten journals of people who...
Handwritten journals.
Yes, handwritten journals of people who were microdosing and sending us journals of their experiences.
Huh. So for those of our listeners who saw Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas or something, you know, and have this image of people on crazy acid trips, let's say... That's not really what we're talking about at all.
That's not what we're talking about at all. The people who are taking microdoses are not experiencing even a little bit of the perception that the world is breathing or that things are shining.
Or there's giant iguanas walking around in their living room.
Sure. So no change.
Unless they live in the Yucatan, but never mind.
They might experience a perceptual change, meaning they can tell that they've taken a microdose, but... not a change in their perceptions, meaning the things that they're seeing haven't changed at all.
Uh-huh. So these, maybe a controversial question, but how do they get these microdoses if they're not doing it directly through the Fadiman group with some sort of permission to do so?
Right. So people all over the world have used LSD, and people are able to find LSD and psilocybin and a number of other substances without that much trouble.
Okay.
And we recommend that everyone test their substances. You can buy on Amazon or through DanceSafe testing kits, and everyone should be testing their substances.
So they test to make sure that it's, first of all, what it's supposed to be
exactly.
In the right concentration, and that the microdose is, in fact, the right amount to be taking.
Yes. And we've moved on from the handwritten journals.
Okay.
Yeah. Just to be clear. Yeah.
So you've moved on from the handwritten journal. How do people record their experiences now? How do you guys work?
So I said to Jim, like, we can't do this with the handwritten journals. I was a graduate student, like, typing them up.
Oh, my goodness.
It was really too much. So I designed these forms
online. Online forms.
Yeah.
Fill-outable forms, not PDFs, right?
They yes, exactly. Fill-outable forms. And people, and we've had several sort of rounds of different things that we've asked people. So the most recent one that we're closing right now is that we ask people about their emotions on a daily basis.
Now, do you scale this? Is it affective, or is it on a scale of 1 to 10? How depressed are you, or how does it work?
We use the PANA scale, the positive and negative negative affect scale.
Okay.
So we used an already...
A pre-established testing system.
Yeah, a pre-established assessment. And what we were able to find was that... And we had a control group as well. So we asked people who were not microdosing to also fill out this scale. And we were able to compare that to the validation literature from the testing company. We found that people with microdoses were less depressed and less anxious over time.
Are those the principal applications that you guys now think in the Fadiman group microdoses of LSD might be appropriate for? Or are there other areas that you noticed?
No, those are the big two things that the scale measures. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So that scale measures depression and anxiety.
The PANA scale measures depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Through looking at a number of different emotions, which are attentive, focused, clear, proud, strong, interested, active, alert, excited, inspired, enthusiastic, and determined for the positive emotions. And for the negative, irritable, depressed, guilty, upset, ashamed, scared, hostile, jittery, nervous, and afraid.
So if there are a diminishment of those negative emotions and an improvement in the positive emotions over the course of a certain period of time, you can say that it actually perhaps has a positive psychoactive effect.
Perhaps. What we don't know at this point is that if people didn't know if they were getting a microdose, if we had a randomized control trial, that the results might be different, and that's what we're looking forward to.
I hate to say this, but no doubt there are some controversies associated with this research. Obviously, if you're going to create a control group, right, and test for the null hypothesis that there's no effect or that there's an effect based on perception, you have to go, there has to be not just kind of a creatively organized system, but it has to follow all the typical scientific modes. What are the prospects for that taking place in the near future? Where are you?
So what we know, actually, and one of the cool parts of this job is that I've been able to work with participants who are organized. So there are psychedelic societies all over the United States and all over the world, and people are interested in trying microdosing. So in Boston, the Psychedelic Interest Group set up their own blinded trial.
Wow.
Which is not to say that it's the same gold standard as you do in a medical trial, but it's certainly something. And they were able to show me their results and their significant results against the null hypothesis.
Against the null hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. And we're looking at We're looking at clinical trials in 12 countries in the next 2 years. That's not only of microdosing, but also macrodosing. Though, obviously, if macrodosing got approved through a government, then it would be easier to get,
microdosing approved. Right.
So in addition to depression and anxiety getting better, we've also seen a number of medical conditions get better, and we didn't expect that. Well, some we did expect in that we expected certain types of headache conditions to get better because the drugs on the market, like sumatriptan, are related to LSD.
Huh. So was that for things like migraines?
Mm-hmm. So migraines, cluster headaches, people with bipolar have a set of interesting results that we're following up on now. People with traumatic brain injury and stroke. So there's people with paralysis. There's a number of things we didn't expect that we're doing follow-ups about now.
Huh. In that research... that's a really broad range and some really important areas in which many of the treatments are unsuccessful today. Migraines come to mind particularly, but all of the areas that you delineated, recovery from stroke, all these are very challenging areas. What's the time frame before those kinds of things might be approved or legalized for more general treatment? Do you know?
Yeah, if the FDA does fast track these types of substances, things could be approved in a number of years.
Like a certain, not 15 years, but 3 years.
But under five.
Under 5 years, mm-hmm. Right.
We would need to have a way of reassuring the government about the safety of these substances. And we know from some safety studies that have been done in, say, Switzerland, that LSD and mushrooms seem to be quite safe for people to take. But we would need to reassure the U.S. government of their safety.
If I can ask, what countries are these studies legally being considered in, or can you talk about that?
Yeah, though I'm not going to be able to name them all off the top of my head.
No, that's all right, just a general smattering.
Sure, in England, in Holland, I think that we're looking at Germany and France.
Primarily
Australia.
Western Europe.
Yeah.
Oh, and Australia.
Australia,
okay.
Certainly Canada. Canada's actually doing a trial of microdosing itself. It's slightly easier in Canada because here in the U.S. we have something called the Analog Act, which means that anything that is an analog
to a drug, even if it's not the original drug, is therefore the same penalties apply. Yeah,
right. So in Canada there is no Analog Act, and they were able to secure permission from Health Canada, which is their governing
national government
to do trials of microdosing, in as opposed to our trial. Those people will be in a lab doing probably fun games, testing their cognitive abilities for the period of time that they're on microdoses. They won't be going about their regular lives.
They won't be driving to work and
right.
doing surgery or whatever it is they do.
Yeah,
for a
and certainly we recommend that people who are doing microdosing, when they first try microdosing, that they have scheduled some time that where they don't have to drive or take care of children or perform surgery, that they really know how microdoses affect them before they're able to.
Probably good advice in any drug situation if you're taking any medication,
right.
Frankly. But certainly if you're doing something that's experimental. Mm-hmm. Sophia, where can people go to find out more about the Fadiman Group, about the work that you're doing, microdosing, the whole picture?
Yeah, you can reach us at www.microdosingpsychedelics.com.
Microdosingpsychedelics.com. That, was that a hard website to get a hold of?
No, that's
a,
that was...
it was available.
Yeah, it was available.
$10 for the year. Sophia, thank you so much. We appreciate it and look forward to hearing more about this in the future.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, which won't be on microdosing, but hopefully will be just as interesting. And we'll get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish. Me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be the creators of the film Sfarad. Our playout this morning is Keshenig Meret Hasufa, When the Storm is Over by Eden Chasson. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
תמיד זה ככה כשנגמרת הסופה כמה זה עולה לי להחזיר אותך בחזרה ואם זה ככה למה שוב מההתחלה איכשהו אף פעם אין לי כוח כשאת מתחילה לדבר אליי בשמי לומר לי מה הקשר שאני שואל פתאום הכל בסדר כל המשפטים
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.